Kauai Soapbox, and our show is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with George's Food Truck, Kilauea Paint and Feed, and we also just want to throw out a nice mahalo to everybody who donated to help keep this station on the air. It just makes all the difference in the world. So, mahalo, mahalo, mahalo.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Chef George of the Jungle Food Truck, now in Wailua at Kamokila Hawaiian Village, serving local burgers, gyros, and falafel. Also, Summer's Organic Shave Ice with fresh fruit. Open Sunday through Friday, 10:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. 783-0230 for takeout. Chef George of the Jungle supports KKCR.
Kilauea Paint and Feed Store, specializing in professional-grade Pittsburgh paints and paint sundries, premium pet food, and organic livestock feed, propane exchange and filling, too, located just past the Shell station on Kolo Road in Kilauea, Monday through Friday from 7:30 to 5:30, and Saturday from 8 to 1, locally owned Kilauea Paint and Feed Store, 828-6655.
For supporting Kauai Community Radio. You make all the difference. So I have two people in the studio with me. I'll make sure they are mic'd up okay. I have Katie Music.
Aloha.
Am I saying your last name right?
Yes.
Okay, because I always, it just sounds like music, even though it's spelled a little different. And backing me up over here is my Ian Cowden. Ian, are you mic'd up okay?
Yes.
Okay, he's there, and so he will be answering the phones at 826-7771. And there's a little bit of a change in today's programming from what I had put on Facebook. Facebook tends to really feed this show. We have a whole dialogue that comes on beforehand, and so we're going to be having an interesting conversation, and we're still going to have it, somewhat about the Navy and the training that they do. I have alerted PMRF, that Pacific Missile Range Facility, and especially, Stephen, if you're listening, if you would like to call in, you are very welcome to be a part of our conversation. The part that has to do with the Navy is concerns over extensions of the training grounds. These things are happening sort of all over the world. Kauai Soapbox is a show where people express what their concerns are, and so we follow up on them. Most of the ones regarding for today was really brought in by people from Alaska. There's an extension on that facility, and so people are very, very nervous about that. Now, my person, Emily Stolarczyk, from up there, she had a little bit of a mistake in understanding the time difference, so she can't be on right now. In the second half of the show, we are going to be addressing some of the concerns regarding the Kauai Humane Society. Many people who work at the like a third of the staff have raised a red flag that they are concerned at the level of non-live exits, euthanasia within there. So when Emily and Penny are in here from the Humane Society at about 5 o'clock, we'll be talking to them and hearing what they have to say and having an opportunity to brainstorm for practices that are a little bit more comfortable with many people that have expressed concerns. So Kauai Soapbox and KKCR does as best a job as they can at trying to create balance while our dominant reflection is that of the less than heard voice in regular mainstream media. Katie?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to have you stop rattling your papers because it's picking up on the mics.
Sorry.
So, and Ian, I was going to just go through a few of the things that are kind of new and on the island right now before we go into a little bit more of the conversation on the military. Graduation, that was a big thing this weekend. Big yay!
Yay!
To Waimea, Kauai High, and Kapa High.
Yeah, and then there's Island School who has another week to go.
I think more than a week.
Yes, a little bit more than a week, but not much.
A week and a half, and you would know because?
I go to Island School and I'm a senior.
You're a senior.
Yep.
So congratulations on that, and I loved seeing all the pictures and all the amounts of joy out there, and because I have a son here who is in that grade, I actually know quite a good deal, an extra amount of kids that just graduated this weekend. So we're very proud of you. And even for those who didn't quite graduate, we still love you. And no worries. There's lots of ways that, you know, you just kind of catch up and keep going. Lots of different ways that people have talents. I somehow in my graduation statement to myself, I wrote down lychees because there's so much lychees out right now. It just seems like a real big point of joy.
I love
lychees, and I especially like them when they're picked completely ripe. Nice and dark and red and sweet. So, many things happening. One that I'm just going to start with is these hurricane possibilities. Seems like we have a really intense weather year this year.
Yeah, two of them now. There was just Andreas, but now there's another one. What was it?
Blanca,
yeah.
And what we can tell when they name hurricane storms or tropical storms, they go A, B, C, D, E. And if they have a Hispanic name, that means that they're coming close to, they start out close to Mexico. And if they have a Hawaiian name, that means they start closer in the middle or part of the Pacific.
Fortunately, they're not too close to us. They are getting closer, but it seems like Andres is slowing down and they're pretty far away from us.
Yeah, I looked at that. I know there's a lot of people who are concerned about it, and because the weather this year is more...
Acting weird,
that, you know, the weather people are calling for probably 8 hurricanes in this area.
I saw a video about the jet stream slowing down what goes around the world from west to east, and it's slowing down. That's why we've been having such long seasons, like such a long winter in like East Coast. And now there's that flooding in Texas, and it's been flooding for so long and so many gallons of water, and that's because the jet streams are slowing down, so it's not changing as fast, the weather, because it's sticking around in that one spot. And then there's also in India the super heat wave, and that's because it's also staying around over there. It's because our jet stream's slowing down.
Did it say why the jet stream is slowing down?
Something about the Arctic. Something's happening in the Arctic. So much change in the Arctic that it's creating a slower jet stream.
And if we have a weather Akamai listener, you're very welcome to call in and help us understand that a little bit more. I know I've been watching a lot on the weather and seeing really interesting pieces, like where there is more ice in the Antarctic, but less thick ice. You know, it's getting wider, but thinner.
Yeah. And then also, my Kumu, my teacher for my Halau class.
And her name is?
Kumu Kauka, or Sabra Kauka. She was warning my class that she noticed when there was Iniki that there was a whole bunch of fruit, fruit being made from the trees and the flowers were being, there was a lot of flowers, and she said that was happening a little bit before Iniki, and that she's seeing it happen again right now. So she is actually concerned about the weather, like the hurricanes, because she, it happened right before Iniki, and it hasn't happened since as much, as strong as it had.
Like excessive flowering on the trees.
Exactly, yeah.
So, in hurricane preparedness, I know the CERT program around the island has been really very active. And then a general rule of thumb, I know at our home we are prepared in that we have plywood for all of our windows, and I have them all numbered. And so that is a really big relief.
And we have water jugs.
We have water jugs. We have a lot of ways that we basically just live hurricane prepared. I keep batteries.
And we live super close to a hurricane shelter.
We do. Nice. So that, and we're pretty lucky on. And so we pay attention, and we are lucky that we have KKCR. We thank the community for, again, donating money. KKCR's inception happened because of Hurricane Iniki and needing to have an emergency preparedness center and radio station, right? We didn't have radio here for a long time. Kong Radio does a really extraordinary job in emergencies, but they can't help it if that system goes down. So we don't get them. Have you ever been in a hurricane, Katie?
Yes, I have.
Where?
In Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. In Puerto Rico and in Okinawa.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I agree with Sabra Kalka. I think that things are stirring up. I measured the water temperature today. It's about 80 at Kailua, which is warm. Last year, it was up to 84 when I noticed the corals bleaching around the island. And we, the corals, and I are already nervous. It's too warm.
So let's shift that point for just a moment to bleaching corals and warm weather. And warm water, right? The warmth of the water, does that bleach the coral?
What's happening is the zooxanthellae, that's the small algae that live inside the coral tissues that give them their brownish or golden color, leave. Whether the coral ejects them or they choose to leave seems to be something that's debated, but the warmth of the water causes those algae to vacate. And you can see right through the coral tissue then, which is transparent because the algae are gone, right to the white skeleton. Corals generally have a white skeleton, like we do, calcium carbonate. So when we see them bleached, they are missing the algae, but if the temperature goes back to normal, then the algae have a chance of coming back.
So the algae are important to the coral because the coral eat the algae?
No, the algae is using the sunshine and making a product, a nutrient, carbohydrates for the coral. So they work together. The algae get a home, and the coral polyps use the product, like we eat the lychees, they eat the product of the...
So there's a symbiotic relationship,
right,
between the coral and the algae, and so the piece that makes the problem of the warmth of the water is the algae take off,
right,
so then they don't have their food source.
Right, they can catch some food with their tentacles, the little polyps, the animals that are the corals, but they rely, especially in shallow water that make the big coral reefs, like the Great Barrier Reef and throughout the Caribbean, they rely on sunshine. So if it's too warm and the algae are gone, then the corals become weaker, and then they become more susceptible to disease. And as we throw more and more garbage into the water in the form of pesticides, biocides, I call them, and bacteria and all the things that we flush down the toilet and reach the corals, then with their weakened immune system, then they die. Last year, I saw some corals actually not recover, but the bulk of them did, I would say.
They recovered from?
From the warmth.
The warmth.
It was hot in September and October, but it cooled off soon enough that they were able to recover.
Okay. And then, so when we are thinking about that, like I have been seeing pictures. There's a person in the community who takes many, many pictures of the reef and the waters and fish and really does an extraordinary job on that. And we're seeing pictures from Nualolo. I haven't been down there for a bit, but Nualolo Kai looks really, really empty, vacant of fish, and it looks pretty exhausted. And Anini is looking pretty tired. We're seeing a lot of areas with really profoundly less life in the ocean. And we have had, when I went to listen to the elders talk about the reef, that, you know, there's really profound change. We have a caller. Aloha, you're on the air. Thank you for holding.
I just wanted to add that I was here during the Niki.
Uh-huh.
And it was the best thing that ever happened to Kauai because it got rid of all the riffraff and people that actually belong here, their wages increased. And we all got together as a community and, you know, maybe it's time. I know it's time. I mean, we're way overdue. But the scary thing is, though, is something like a Niki hit Oahu.
Like a Niki hit Oahu, that would be a profound problem.
We would be in deep caca. So, I don't know. My advice would be to all the condominium complex, make sure you got your hurricane insurance paid up, homeowners, hurricane insurance paid up, and... you know, I mean, it's only material stuff anyhow, but I don't know.
So when you talk about having your insurance paid up, also say put it in a safe deposit box in the bank or somewhere where it's going to stay available to help be able to find it, because that is a problem when you can't even find it.
Oh, yeah. I would recommend that your birth certificate, all your ID stuff, insurance policies, all that, yeah, put away somewhere safe, because it gets scrambled. It does get scrambled. All right, Felicia, okay. You're doing a great job. Thanks for your show.
Okay, thank you.
Aloha.
Aloha. So when we are talking about challenges to the reef, and we're talking about the military, what do you feel with this sonar? Because that's what's happening for the people in the Arctic. They're having a whole new training piece. We read an article on it where in the Gulf of Alaska, this is a fisheries protected area. It's called the Northern Edge is the name of the training effort. And it's happening right in the fishing season. And I think that part of their big fear is when they have this naval operation there, it puts all kinds of contaminants in the water. And their whole economy is based on fishing, plus their livelihood is based on fishing. So that's a very big piece of their concern.
As I understand it, all five species of salmon are there in that gulf, and they are the backbone, so to speak, of the whole economy there. Fishermen and the native peoples. And so if we start, or if we permit the Navy to do bombing practice, it isn't just sonar. They're releasing toxic chemicals and they're bombing ships. And I'm reminded of what I've seen on this planet of other places like Vieques. As you know, I lived in Puerto Rico both as a child and from 1995 to 2007. And that was during the time that there were big protests on Vieques to stop the bombing. And they've still shown that many people living downwind of the bombing site are contaminated and have cancers that are higher than other levels in the country, not to mention the fish. You know, these chemicals all bioaccumulate. So it's been stopped, and so it's a possibility that it could be stopped again, but it's a very difficult situation because both the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA are not objecting. They're allowing the Navy to do what they want to.
Well, that's, I think, what is very concerning to the people in Alaska, and the group that she represents is called the Iak Preservation Council. It is mostly Native Alaskans, and right now many of them are out in the water. It was another interesting thing that I learned. When they're permitted to fish, they get a 36-hour fishing window. So they go out and they can only fish right in that window of time. So it is a big deal, and that is happening for the fishermen themselves.
That happened to me in Okinawa, too. There was a place I liked to dive on the other side of Iejima, which means Iejima Island. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I could dive and study the corals there, but not other days of the week because they were practicing bombing. And I would often find unexploded ordnance in the water. It was pretty scary.
Wow.
So the local fishermen around the world have experienced American bombing practice or real bombs. And as you mentioned about the weather, I'm sure there's a link with the melting of the Arctic. The Navy's up there to practice, because as the ice is melting, it'll be a new place to transport stuff around the world. And so the weather changes we are seeing are related to what your son said about the changes in the atmosphere, and then bringing in more Navy and more militarization and more destruction. So not only the warming water and the acidification of the water hurting animals, but then purposely bombing them.
I see here that the species they know will be affected are bluefin, gray whales, humpback whales, blue whales, mink, something called say, I don't know what that is, sperm whales, and killer whales.
And the North
Dolphins
Pacific,
and sea lions,
yeah,
as well.
The North Pacific right whale also. There are only 30 left in the world. It's unbelievable.
So this is a tough thing, and it looks like the native tribes that are a part of this action is Eskimo, Eyak, Athabascan, forgive me for not getting these quite right, Tlingit, Sanak, and Aleut. They rely on these areas for subsistence living, and it is very, very key to their cultural identity. So that sounds a lot. Last week I had people here from Mauna Kea. It was a very lively and interesting, beautiful show. Several of whom have now arrived in Poland. So what's beautiful about everything that's going on is the whole world is getting together. Everybody's sort of sharing their interests, sharing. It's in a way that I don't think has happened, you know, before this decade, before social media and heavy internet interaction.
Well, it's very exciting. Even here in Hawaii, the new governor, Ige, is part Okinawan. And just this last week, the governor of Okinawa was visiting him in Oahu and then went on to Washington, D.C., where he is today. He met with Senator McCain yesterday. As you know, most of the population of Okinawa is against having the military presence expanded, which is what they're trying to do. And they're happening to put a new extension of a marine base on top of the last coral reef ecosystem in Okinawa. There was a rally last week of 50,000 people.
Where?
In Okinawa, at the capital. And the new governor was elected by a landslide because he's against the militarization of Ora Bay. It's one of the most spectacular places left on the planet. So my point being that this was hard to get out in the news, but now Ige understood a little because he's part Okinawan and an Okinawan came here. And the same problems that we have with the bay are the same as Mauna Kea.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting, because what I'm seeing is this really incredible disconnect between worldviews of many people. And sometimes, like when I go, like I went to see Brian Chatt speak, and he did a decent job. The thing that was interesting is he talked about a completely different set of interests with the group that came to see him than was the influence of the people who are out there with signs and protesting. And, it's kind of stunning, because I think, are we on different planets? How come when these speakers come and talk, when these political leaders come and talk, they don't say, I get it that you're very concerned or afraid or disturbed by what's happening in this area. I understand, and it's important, even if we don't see it in the same perspective. To me, when they don't begin with something like that, I'm usually very startled.
It's a critical question to ask. Why do some people get it and others don't? An essay I wrote last week and published in the Asia Pacific Journal is about the sense of sacred. The people who think that Mauna Kea is sacred, and people that live in Okinawa who think the bay is sacred and that life in it is a treasure, we are seeking a way to make other people care. How can we lead them to understand what we feel? McCain years ago said that this new base was not necessary and was expensive and not needed, but yesterday he said, go ahead.
John McCain
and Abe and Obama are strengthening the military
in Okinawa
and in China and
what
Korea.
About Jeju Island?
Well, that's a supposedly South Korean project, and they destroyed most of the beautiful coral forest there to make way for a huge new port, and the port is big enough for destroyers. And we are the nation that has destroyers, and so we are beefing up the Navy over there. The Jeju Island is the southern part of Korea, and it has corals which are quite similar to what I studied in Okinawa because of the current that comes up from Philippines. It's a warm place. The water's beautiful, and it's known as the Island of Peace. But there were many, many protests for the last few years, all to no avail. And we went ahead and blew up the rocks and killed the life and the culture of the people there. So, once again, Jeju or Okinawa or Alaska, it's the same problem over and over again. But it's uniting us. And one thing I liked reading about the woman that was supposed to, I don't know how to...
Emily.
Emily, all right. She said it takes a spark to start a fire, so she's not giving up on this fight. And in Vieques, in Puerto Rico, they eventually won. It took 60 years. In Okinawa, they've been protesting for 70 years, but eventually we hope to win before the last coral is dead.
Right. So whether we're looking at what's in the sea or when we look at Pahakuloa, which is up there at the crest of Mauna Kea right next to Poliahu Crater, there's a lot of munitions training and depleted uranium. All of that's right in the cradle of the top of their watershed. Now, here's the converse side of that argument. When we have military that we send places, whether it's, you know, I mean, it's not their fault, the politics behind the, you know, the movements of the military. So we need to have them trained well so they are safe. That's sort of a responsibility that we have. It's just tough for me, and I'm owning it. I've never been in the military. My dad was in the service in World War II, but that was like 15 years before I was even born, so I don't have a strong military influence in my life. But I don't see how we can keep, you know, doing all this stuff for peace when we are destroying everything. It seems like a Pyrrhic victory. I'm reading here about the Alaska, and it says, the Navy is permitted to use live ordnances, including bombs, missiles, and torpedoes, along with active and passive sonar in realistic wargaming that is expected to involve the release of as much as 352,000 pounds of expended material every year. And so, you know, that's a lot of impact.
The obvious conclusion that I will make is that this is part of the military-industrial complex, and they need to keep on making things and breaking them to continue the military. And so this is driven by economics. It's not driven by peace or needs for peace. In Okinawa, they've said, we don't need the military there anymore. We have enough tourism. They tried to say that the military was important to the economy, but they're showing that they can do with peaceful activities.
Yes, you can definitely build and create things, including even helping other countries, I think, would be a good way to work on it.
For example, instead of missiles, make windmills.
Right. So you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, K-A-Q-A, Kilauea. We are at 4:30. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. Katie and Ian are in the studio with me. If you would like to call in, it's 826-7771. And we have a couple of announcements.
Laser Bear Productions presents Dave Mason's Traffic Jam. One night only on Friday, June 12th, at the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7:30. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer and co-founder of the legendary band Traffic, Dave Mason, performing with his band all the hits, including Dear Mr. Fantasy, Feeling All Right, and We Just Disagree. A journey back to the greatest days of rock with Dave Mason's sight and sound experience. Traffic Jam. Information, tickets, and Golden Circle at 808-896-4845 or at laserbear.com. LazarBear.com.
KKCR, the staff and volunteers would love to thank all the amazing restaurants and businesses that fed our volunteers during our spring membership drive. A big mahalo to Papayas in Kapa'a, Pauhana Pizza in Kilauea, Monaco's in Wailua, Coconut Cup in Kapa'a, Barracuda in Hanalei, The Greenery Cafe in Lihue, Al Pastor Tacos in Kapa'a, Kayla Cook's Catering, Harvest Market in Hanalei, Healthy Hut in Kilauea, North Shore Grinds in Princeville, Yaw Caduce Organic Bagels, and Kilauea Fish Market. Yum!
And mahalo for waiting, holding. You are on the air.
Hi, this is Kuhan Pak, a.k.a. Camera, former resident of Kauai, now on the Big Island.
And
hi, how is everybody over there?
Good, and you know how much I love you.
Well, I love you, too. And then when I heard from Katie in an email this morning that she was going to be on your show, I thought, oh, well, I've got to call in. But I wanted to, I don't know, Katie, if you saw the article that I emailed you by Sasha Davis about these islands that are being built by China.
Yes.
But this is in the news lately, and, you know, we were talking about the motivation for all of this hyped-up militarization and pivot to the Pacific pivot. A lot of our funding, tax money, is going into arming the Pacific, and it's so important that we talk about this because we are ground zero for all the decision-making. We have the most firepower in the world right here in Hawaii. We're the PICO. We're the center not only of the Hawaiian cosmos, but also of the Pentagon's idea of where the weight of the world's economy is for the 21st century. And so China is building these islands, right, because they want to start staking claims in the Western Pacific along their border. And this has a lot to do with the U.S. ramping up all of these bases being built. So sometimes they're U.S. bases, like in Okinawa, and other times they're bases that are built officially by the client states, like South Korea with Jeju Island, or Japan with a new base that's just got built, that just got the okay to be built at Yonaguni, which is a place that Katie has also dived at.
Yes, Yonaguni is, you can see Taiwan from Yonaguni. It's still part of the ancient Ryukyu archipelago. The islands of Okinawa extend from Kyushu in the north almost down to Taiwan, and the military is bringing down ospreys and other instruments of destruction to all these islands. They're
right,
setting
so
up.
Yesterday, the 30 residents of Yonaguni filed an injunction to stop the troops from coming down to Yonaguni. Now, Yonaguni, how can I describe it? It's, would you say, like, it's one of the most pristine places on the planet, Katie?
It's, sure, it's remote from, people don't go there. Except,
like, I saw a picture, it looks like Wales. It looks like a tiny island that resembled Wales with Japanese architecture. I mean, absolutely stunning. And, I mean, the thing that just rips me apart is the most stunning, beautiful, remote places are being destroyed, whether it be under the guise of the official U.S. military, like an Okinawan base, the U.S. bases in Okinawa, or, like I say, other countries that are basically yes men for the U.S. or our allies. But whatever you want to call it, some people call them lily pad bases because they can then grow from, they start out as a little lily pad and then they can grow. There's one now in Darwin, Australia, and I don't know if that's a U.S. base. Oh, actually, that's under the Australian flag. But it's almost like geographic borders don't even count anymore. It's this global elite that of teams of allies that are on the U.S. side versus China that is just really carry, you know, holds a really good hand of cards in terms of their numbers of people, productivity, resources, and but I must say, people always say, well, China's, they're building their military strength, they're building their military strength. There are 450 U.S. bases already in the Asia Pacific, with more coming, and that's not even the client state bases or the Arctic bases. And the thing that kills me, and Katie, I know this as well, is the environmental devastation is just dreadful. It's not, we can't let it happen anymore. It's not, let alone these phony islands that China's building out by the Philippines that are like 2,000 acres of crushed coral that is piled on to, and made into these islands.
Right. I've been following those islands, and I know that they're ramping up the Philippine bases again, too, the U.S.
So how, this is the first time I've heard about this.
Oh, it's
so
huge.
So let me just ask a few novice questions. Why put them on a fabricated island instead of just on the shore?
Because there are disputes, territorial ocean disputes, between China and the Philippines over something called the Spratly Islands.
Okay, I know
there
where those are.
There are also territorial disputes in the south. This is the South China Sea. So in this area, we've got disputes with the country of Brunei, with Vietnam, with possibly Malaysia, but the Philippines is the big one. And by building fake islands there, then China claims its maritime law, territory law, over that, like, I think it's 12 kilometers from these fake islands now China owns. And why did they, like, for example, yesterday, so the U.S. is kind of very, very, very concerned about it, and they've been sending over like fighter jets that intentionally go within the 12-mile kilometer to show that they're absolutely flouting this this boundary that China's determining is theirs. And they're just saying, no, no, that's their way of saying, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And the Chinese are sending out, like, huge bullhorn messages in English, go away, you are in enemy territory, go away, you are trespassing.
But they don't retreat. And so this is lately in the news been talked about as being a flashpoint for the next world war.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. And then, Kuhan, just to help the listener know, you are been very informed for quite a long time on this topic, yes?
Yeah, I've been following this for almost my whole life, just casually, because I did, like Katie, I grew up in a U.S. territory. I was grew up in Guam. I also grew up in Korea. My father was born in North Korea. So I have a lot of interest in the way that Asia Pacific is militarized. But mostly my interest comes from the fact that the most unknown places are the most magical and beautiful places you can even imagine. These places, and because nobody knows about them, there's no any kind of protest movement to oppose their desecration and destruction. I think one of the reasons the Mauna Kea movement, which I've watched and admired and been inspired by, especially because it's like right here in my backyard, is that, you know, Hawaii gets a lot of play, mountains get a lot of play. Mountains are very masculine, and I think that that's really mediagenic for, like, social media. But I think when you're talking about remote, tiny islands in a vast ocean sea that is so obscure and abstract, it's really hard to get any friction or traction with that, even though these places are far more remote and untouched and pristine. I mean, on the top of Mauna Kea, they've found mercury at Lake Waiau. It's sullied already by those telescopes. But I'm not comparing, I don't mean to compare sacred spots. What I mean to say is that I'm absolutely devastated and heartbroken to know that places like Pagan Island, which is probably, in my opinion, could be the most beautiful tropical island in the Pacific, it's not inhabited now. But there are people living there, but it's completely off the grid. Nobody has electricity. There's no power plant. There's no store. There's no money. There's no economy. It's just people living, basically fishing and living in grass huts.
But we're going to have target practice there now.
Yeah, full spectrum bombing, torpedoes, submarines. And I guess what you talked about my background, and Katie can speak to this as well, is that when you grow up in these places, And you resonate with them growing up, they become part of you. You'll do anything to defend them. So yes, I've been very, very much following militarization of the Pacific, just because the most exquisite, beautiful, unimaginably pristine places are going to be used for 365 day a week live fire training, submarine torpedoes, sonar, basically like a gangbang for the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army.
We have an advantage with Alaska, because in Hawaii, many people go back and forth to Alaska. And Alaska has the last best salmon on this planet, you know.
We love our salmon.
So this has got a chance. Just like Mauna Kea, there are more people that know about Alaska.
And the last time I had you in the studio, it seemed like maybe that was 2 or 3 years ago, and you were on your way to Jeju Island. But for people who don't know, Jeju Island is famous for the women divers that go like 80 feet, and they get, what do they get down there when they dive?
Well, they dive without any gear.
Yeah, free diving.
Just on lung power alone. And, you know, I don't think they're getting much in that area now, but...
Because it's ruined, but I mean, like,
octopus,
people that...
Octopus, abalone, tons of abalone,
all kinds of mollusks.
There's 70 species of mollusks that were growing and thriving in one of the possibly only rocky wetland coastlines in the world. And what I mean by that is, imagine the Kona, like lava coast, but imagine freshwater springs all over that you can actually drink out of because it's so pure. And in those springs are all these mollusks. And the springs are coming from their Mauna Kea, which is a volcanic mountain in the middle of their island, and it takes 100 years for the water to filter through the lava and come up. So can you imagine how pure and mineralized and perfect that water is? That's been paved over. That whole coastline is paved over, and there's like these institutional concrete buildings there, and now it's a base. And by next year, they're going to have, like Katie says, these huge aircraft carriers coming in, the largest of which is the USS George Washington. It's the largest in the world, and they had specific instructions to make sure you dredge this deep enough, of course, dredge all the coral out, so that this USS George Washington can port there.
I did an environmental impact assessment, and I was trying to figure out how much force would be generated by these huge ships and would blow the corals off their rocks. You know, it's not the kind of data that you can easily find. It isn't just physically removing the rocks, but it's all the turbulence and all the sedimentation that goes on later. So,
and the thing that's so tragic, Katie, right, is that this is happening all over. These war games are destroying the planet. I mean, for humans, we're not at war with war games, but for the planet, it's like we're waging war on the planet every time we do military practice. And if it's supposed to secure, you know, give us our security, it's not. It's destroying our security. And yet what we've got is these two hegemons, which is China and the U.S. now, sort of battling it out and killing everything in sight as they do it.
And last time that you went there, did you get arrested? I remember seeing the videos of nuns and all kinds of villagers. It was like the whole village were laying down in front of the machines
Yeah, the whole village does, and plus people of the cloth come from the mainland Korea to join in with the protests. And I didn't get arrested. I go out of my way to not get arrested in foreign countries because, like our friend, Katie and my friend, Imok Chab, was deported because they caught wind that she was about to present an environmental impact statement that Katie worked on and presented at the IUCN, which is the International Union for Conservation of Nature, who will be having their meeting, their quadrennial meeting, next year in Honolulu.
Right after IMPACT, by the way.
Their last one, which attracts 10,000 environmentalists from all over the world. We had Imok, like, really quickly put together, scientists go out there, do studies, put together an EIS, and she had it all together as a PowerPoint, and they met her at the airport of South Korea in Seoul and said, "You are not welcome in Korea. You must go back." And they put her on the next plane back to the mainland. She lives in San Francisco. The next plane was to Seattle. She had to turn right around and go back. They wouldn't tell her why. But it was clear because she was going to present the next day the findings of her EIS, which was in conflict with what the government was saying about the devastation to the coral reef, which is a UNESCO biosphere preserve.
Well, those films, the videos that I was watching, remind me in even more stark atrocity. I mean, you know, what we saw in Mauna Kea was at least nonviolent arresting. It did not look particularly nonviolent arresting in Jeju Island. It could be worse, but we're seeing, like, in Brazil, down there, people are, those villagers are dying trying to protect from the dam that's going in. I mean, this is something that's happening all over the planet.
Right. It's money, it's trade, and then the military exists not to protect anything except trade. That's what the military, I don't know what it was like during World War II, I wasn't around, but I know that now, like, the reason why China's building those islands there, why is that territory so important? It's important because that's the strait through which all the oil that comes from the Middle East comes up to China. Right now, the U.S. has all these military outposts and ships, so they're able to control that. There hasn't been any problem because the U.S. is dependent upon China's manufacturing so we can fill our Walmarts up. But China, now that it's growing, it's getting a stronger economy, it doesn't want its people to just be sweatshop workers forever. It wants to start taking control of the seas that are pretty close, you know, along its coastline. I mean, can you imagine if our country, our continent, was encircled with bases from China? We would feel uncomfortable with that. Well, now that they're growing in power and they want to have a more affluent population, they want to take control of that sea route through which all the oil comes from the Middle East to their capitals, and they're even calling it the maritime silk route. And at the same time, they're building channelways to transport oil from by land, and it's very wild and mountainous over there. So that's been, until now, that's been a difficult feat. And while they call that channel the maritime silk route, they're calling the islands they're building the great sand wall of China or something like that.
Have you followed the Trans-Pacific Partnership much?
Yeah. It's linked. It's all linked.
It sounds pretty linked to me. And I know China has its own element, you know, its own partnership that it's wanting to put out. So there's almost a leapfrogging going on that. And I know you're pretty good at doing a lot of research. What are you seeing with that?
Well, I don't want to steal away Katie's time, so...
Oh, I'm here for...
Are you okay with it, Katie?
I'm fine. I just want to make one comment that up in Alaska, it's about the reserves of oil and gas. As the Arctic melts, the war games are not just practicing within the Navy. These are to extract and burn the oil and gas that are there, and ultimately. And we shouldn't be taking the oil and the gas in the first place. But when we are practicing, it's just because we're trying to keep a hold of those reserves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing with China and the Great Barrier Reef. To me, I see these things as being so connected. Right now, the Great Barrier Reef is being dredged so they can ship the coal to China. Mm-hmm. And we even had China participating in RIMPAC. So I don't think of China as a foe so much. I liked your word leapfrog. We're just using each other to keep on keeping on. These war games and these...
Well, it's a very strange dance that China and the U.S. is playing, because there are definite, I mean, who wouldn't feel threatened when there were several Aegis missile bases with missiles pointed at you within like 100 miles, 300 miles, you know, Jeju, Yonaguni, whatnot. Who wouldn't feel threatened by that? On the other hand, they're mutually interdependent, so it's just a very strange, dysfunctional relationship. And regarding TPP, well, that's the trade expression I would think of. That would be the expression of the gathering of allies at an economic level, at a trade level. And China has their own treaties and pacts and bilateral agreements with different countries in the area as well. And they're also, like, the number one investor now in Africa and in South America. So this is why, really, I don't know if you'll see this in writing anywhere, because I just say this from my own research. You know how we create these huge marine monuments, right, that so-called supposedly protect areas, the marine areas?
Like Papahanaumokuakea?
Exactly.
Which is the northwest Hawaiian Islands, and we have this expansion of the whale sanctuary that people have a lot of concern over.
Right, and what people don't know is that Northwest Hawaiian Islands marine monument overlaps with the, what do they call it? I think they might call it the Northwest Hawaiian Island Military Practice Range.
Yes, it does. And then have you been paying attention to, like, the underseas drilling, not drilling, harvesting of materials, like in this whale sanctuary, they have pieces in there lifting the prohibition for removing the substrate and for prohibiting the silt and everything that can happen from the removal of the substrate. So that to me doesn't sound very much like protecting
the Northwest Hawaiian Islands.
No, that's in our expansion of the whale sanctuary that goes up the Hanalei River and all around Ni'ihau. And so
So they're mineral mining or something?
Well, that's what it sounds like. It's going to be at least allowing for. It explicitly removes that prohibition, at least in one of the alternatives.
Well, that's exactly kind of what I was driving at, is what it does. The whole environmental angle is just lip service, because what it really does is it's the U.S. laying claim to territory. Now, they might call it a marine monument, but they're the ones that get to determine what goes on in that marine monument. They might call it. It's total greenwashing. And the point I was getting to about trade with China and their investments in South America is they made one of the new marine monuments last year that was designated. I think it was called the Remote Islands, and it stretches down into the Southern Hemisphere, and it is a complete blockage of China's ability to control the seas from Asia to South America, because it's all about who's controlling the Pacific.
That's right. And then so you use the term greenwashing. Can you explain that for people who don't know that phrase?
Well, why don't you explain it?
Okay. Well, to me, greenwashing is like whitewashing. Greenwashing makes something sound warm and fuzzy to the people who look at things from the perspective of the environment. A lot of times we really only have time to read the headlines because we're working so hard or we got so much going on. There's so many things to worry about. And you see something that says, hey, you know, let's expand the whale sanctuary. And you think, why not? Keep them safe.
Right. That's a perfect. Or, you know, the most obvious lie of greenwashing, of course, was when Monsanto would say, you know, let's feed a hungry, you know, don't you want to feed a hungry planet? Well, yeah, I do. Let's support GMOs. I mean, that's what.
Right. So there's a lot of spin, and even I've noticed, like, on most of the GMO material that they give out, they're beautiful pictures of Hanalei Valley. You know, mm-hmm. Beautiful pictures of the taro fields, as it says, oh, we're doing these good things. And we were given a really great field trip, my students, last year. We went to one of the biotech companies, and they showed us what they were doing. They didn't really convince the kids, because the kids come from families that are concerned about it. But we were driving away, and they were given a nice little gift and a card. And then they kind of panicked in the van, because they're looking at Hanalei, and they're going, uh-oh, you know, they've moved up here. I said, no, honey, they're just using a picture of our side, because we have that.
Because we don't have GMOs.
Well, and because it looks like water and paradise, and so, you know, it's just the most beautiful scenic view. They couldn't take that picture of Kekaha, where it has been stripped of all the mangoes and the things that once had given it the big pieces of abundance.
In fact, the Kalo has been protected from the GMO companies, right? Walter Riddy was
absolutely
was there.
I protested and spent the night at Iolani Palace so that they wouldn't GMO those Kalos. And it's so funny that that's what they use to advertise their GMOs.
That's right. They advertise their own stuff with our side of the island. So that's, you know, people have trouble with trust. And that's one of the reasons. I really appreciate your calling in. We're going to...
Yes, thanks, Felicia. And I'm just, like, glad that this is being covered. It's so important.
Thank you, and I gotta stay in touch with you. I've missed you since you've moved away, so I appreciate you very much calling.
All right, I appreciate you too. Take care. Bye, Katie.
Bye, bye. Great to hear you.
Bye, bye. Okay, and Ian, you have an event coming up, and Katie has an event coming up, so I'm going to give you guys each a moment to share. Okay, Katie, what events do you have coming up?
Well, I'm most excited about the junior lifeguards. I'm going to be helping one day a week, which is fabulous for me, to meet 13 to 17-year-olds who signed up for all the lifeguard, junior lifeguard programs this summer in June and July, Kalapaki, South Poipu side, and Salt Pond and Hana Lake.
Great, great.
And then they'll help me with my underwater project in Kapa'a, which is Mala Moana. As the Navy is obliterating the oceans, I am trying to help bring attention to the problems and see what we can do. And I'd like to mention, too, that with the problem that brought me here today about Alaska is always, what can we do besides protesting at Mauna Kea? And what can the natives up in Alaska do? They can have government-to-government consultations, or we can file major lawsuits, but all of these are really a long shot. So the most important thing, I think, is to have people learn as they're young, when they're young, to have the same kind of awe and happiness that I feel in the ocean and that Kuhan feels for her part of the world and you feel for Hanalei. We have to start when we're young, and then we keep it, and we love what we can
right.
keep.
And we expand the talents of the kids. And have a kid in here who used to have a show on this station, and what do you want to share, Ian?
Well, sidetrack from the saving the environment. I mean, you can save yourself by coming down to the Kapa'a Art Night and listening to some free music that my band OCDC will be putting on from around 6:30 to 9 o'clock, 7 to 9 o'clock.
Is that Saturday? Saturday?
Yeah, Saturday, June 6th. And it's going to be near Paniola Grill, what's behind the Glass Shack in that little shopping center.
That's fantastic.
Square.
You guys, OCDC played for one of my first fundraisers on the Saturday night. You were awesome.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah.
So you have a song queued up, is that
right? Yes, I will sample you a song. Well, it's actually out on SoundCloud to listen for free. You can go to the website and just listen to it for free. And we'll be playing it at the show on June 6th.
Okay, and you guys got a couple of those on here. And when we come back after the top of the hour, we're going to have some of our leaders from the Kauai Humane Society, and they'll be talking this little animal file over here, who's got me with a whole menagerie of pets in my world. You did? You brought them home. He's denying it.
Thank you, Felicia.
Oops, am I doing it right? Okay. KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, and that is OCDC. They'll be playing June 6th, this Saturday night, at the Kapa'a Art Night. You can go listen to them, and we have him in the studio. So you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. When we come back on the air, we're going to be having our leaders from the Kauai Humane Society.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Moloa'a, K284AL, Haleiwa.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456.
808 Equipment Rentals, providing tractor, bobcat, and BCS tiller services island-wide, including pasture mowing, garden bed raising, vegetation removal, terracing, gravel spreading, and more. 808 Equipment Rentals in Moloa'a. 823-1000.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. And we're going to hold calls for a little while, and by about 5:30, we're going to be taking calls at 826-7771. And I have Emily LaRocque. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, Emily LaRocque.
LaRocque. Okay, it looks like a French name. Is that right?
Yes.
And then I have Penny Sestaro.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Then, so thank you for coming in. And I'll just be straight up that when I was seeing a lot of stuff in both the press and then got calls, Kauai Soapbox is where people call when they have concerns about what's going on out there. I came in to talk to you folks in the Humane Society because I do my very best to go straight to the source with whatever might be the concern. So if I can frame what I read to be the concern is, we have over 4,000 animals that are relinquished or taken into the Humane Society every year on this island, with about 65,000 people. So if you do the math on that, you know, we all got to either have a whole lot of pets or we have trouble placing them. Is that fair to say?
That's a fair statement, yes.
That's a fair statement. And so there's a lot of concern that many of these animals aren't surviving. And we all love our animals. And I don't envy you in the position that you're in, because that can't be easy or pleasant to have to decide where they go and what they do. But there's more than one option, right? There's more than just the option of being adopted and the option of not staying alive. What are the options that you have when animals come into the shelter?
Depending upon the individual animal, we have a lot of different options. So we can evaluate the animal based on the age, health, temperament, physical condition. We can determine, does this animal need to go into a foster program and be raised until it's of adoption weight or adoption age, or its physical condition or its health improves. We can place the animal into adoption. We may also be able to find the original owner of that animal and place the animal back into its original home. because the animal was wearing identification, had a microchip, someone came in looking for their lost animal. We can also transfer the animal to one of our partners on the mainland. We have five different shelters that we are transferring to.
Why would they want you to have an animal transfer? What kind of animal would you transfer to the continental United States? Why would they want to take an animal?
We have some very unique dogs here. So we have the Little Whippet Hound mix. We have the Airedale Whippet mix. We have the Hound Pit, the Hound Airedale, Pit Airedale. These are very unusual looking dogs that they don't have on the West Coast. And they're anywhere between 40 and 60 pounds, and they're unique. And so they can go to the mainland and within less than a week be adopted into a new home. And here on Kauai, they sit in our adoption kennels for sometimes 2-3 months without anyone looking at them.
Okay.
So we've taken advantage of that.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, I did just have a caller who's upset with my policy of wanting to give a half hour before having calls. He says that's not part of the mission statement. I would say, you know, he's pretty close to right on that one, so I'll split the difference. Let's go 7 to 8 more minutes, so I'm going half on that. Can the both of you, I want to give you a few minutes to be able to speak to what you consider is the biggest concern. My goal in the show is to find a win-win. Like, what we want is to be able to manage our animals effectively and help people to understand what the challenges are. I'm sure it's somewhat finances, space, and then only how long can an animal basically live in a cage and stay happy. That's just my perspective. But Emily, you are the president of the board of directors, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So that means, even though I'm assuming you're a volunteer, you're essentially Penny's boss.
Correct.
So, boss, tell us why. What's happening? Let's help the listener. I'm assuming this caller isn't happy. Tell us what's happening and why it's happening.
Sure. So Kauai Humane Society is an open intake shelter, and so we have to set policy and manage the shelter in a way that handles all of the issues of the cats and dogs and other animals on the island. That is a constrained problem, both, as you mentioned, in finances, but in space and just pure numbers. So the board has, you know, works with the executive director to set policies, and we monitor those to make sure that we're moving in accordance with that. The issue historically, for many years, dating back to records that we have back to 2010, read towards what you stated. There's so many animals coming in and just not enough resources and ways to find homes for every animal. So we've worked with Penny worked with her on programs designed for such an open intake type shelter to tailor those towards targeting towards a zero euthanasia result. Now, in looking at the numbers and the statistics of in all the areas in euthanasia and in animals coming in and live release, the numbers prior to Penny have been very stable, that there has been no real improvement. Since Penny's been here, the euthanasia rates and the euthanasia numbers of animals have been going down, as is the actual intake of animals is going down. So those numbers are improving. However, I think the concern within the community is that the numbers still overall do not look good, and that is true.
Yes,
I think that's where some of the concerns are. And I think some confusion may be out there that things have, regarding the statistics, gotten worse since Penny has been on board. But if you look at the numbers, they've actually trended in more of an improved fashion. But
well, I see that. I appreciate that you've given me the numbers, but what I do see is a whole lot less are coming in the door.
Yes, and if our programs are working as designed, we are specifically targeting programs to reduce the animals coming into the door. So if you look at, for example, owner surrender for both cats and dogs, Since 2013, those numbers are drastically going down, and we attribute those to the programs working as designed, meaning we have programs like Food Bank, programs like Behavioral Hotline, where at-risk homes and at-risk animals that we would otherwise in previous years would be seeing coming into the shelter are now staying at home. So again, in us seeing the improvement in these programs working as designed is why, you know, we see that the Humane Society is moving in the right direction. I think people may not realize that these numbers have been so poor for so long. They are not new. And then I think also people rightly, I would love to see every animal find a home as well, but I think people rightly are upset at the overall statistic. But that's an issue for the entire island. If you look at the other islands as well, their statistics look very similar to ours. I think it's an issue in Hawaiian Islands with a feral cat population, with stray dogs, with hunting dogs coming into the shelter in very large numbers. It's a cultural problem. It's a island problem that has historically been here, and we do see movement in the positive direction, and I can only speculate that the community does not see it moving fast enough or that the overall numbers are so poor.
It looks like cats are euthanized at 3 times the rate of dogs. Is that because there are more of them or the feral cat population? Penny, you have something to say?
It's a combination of both. There are more feral cats. There are more cats coming into the shelter than dogs. And it's usually, as you said, I think it was last year, there were 900 more cats coming in than dogs coming into the shelter. And our greatest intake is feral cats and unsocialized community cats. And that is our greatest euthanasia number as well. And that's the sad outcome of what has happened with the feral cat population on this island.
So I have a question. Since at least what I have observed from reading the papers and just what has come to my attention is that it is a portion of the staff that raised their hand. Do I have that accurately, that they're like a third of the staff were unhappy? Is that correct? That's
we have received concerns from staff, yes.
So the staff, I would presume, would be different than the general population that aren't paying enough attention, that the staff actually would see the continuity of how the change is shifting, right? So I see economically that the shelter is actually becoming more solvent. Am I reading that right, that it was in trouble and it's looking like funding was dropping, there's all
right.
kinds of things, so that the management has at least been able to stabilize the shelter being able to be there. Is a very expensive gift somebody gave, but then I don't, because that was donated money that built the shelter, correct? It was like $3 million. I'm just remembering from in the past, some rich person donated the money for this. I remember the old shelter in Port Allen was pretty pretty intense. So this compared to that is a resort. It's a much nicer place. I'm sure it costs money just to be maintaining it. So there's nuances. I am not deep at understanding this challenge. So when the callers start calling in, some of them are going to know more deeply than I do. But I'm seeing that there are less animals coming in, less perishing by, you know, well over 1,000 per year, is at least if these numbers are correct that I'm seeing here. There's less that are going away. So I'm not totally sure where people are feeling a big difference. It looks like somebody's calling in. Maybe that they will have that. But I'm at least looking at the numbers, and I'm seeing that the euthanasia rate or the euthanasia numbers is down by over 1,000 animals in the past few years. Do I have a call? No. Okay.
The numbers are trending down for euthanasia, and the animals, if you look at our transfer numbers, since our transfer program started about 2.5 years ago, we've put over 600 animals into the transfer program, and our adoptions are increasing, and one of the spectacular results of our field trip program is a lot of the visitors are adopting the animals that they spend time with on the field trip. So a lot of our different programs are being targeted at getting the animals out, but also the goal of the shelter is to decrease the number of animals coming in so that the resources we have, we can spend on what we are getting into the shelter. And then the animals that we have available for adoption, they are there for an extended period of time in many cases. We have dogs that are there for weeks or months. We have cats that are there for months at a time. So there isn't a set holding period for an animal once the animal makes it into the adoption area. The animals will stay available as long as they're happy, healthy, and well adjusted. And our incredible volunteer program and the field trip program helps us do that for the animals.
And when people hear me talk about the field trip, I playfully call it, you know, if you want to rent a dog or a cat and go play with them, particularly a dog, you know, you can go in and do that and not miss your pet at home so much. I know I dropped by as a surprise visit on you all the other day when I came in to see if you wanted to come in and talk because I was hearing concern. It happened as I was perusing around. I saw that five animals that day had gotten on a plane. I was kind of surprised to California. I saw a video that said that it was about some kittens that were picked up at Salt Pond. And so that looked like those kittens had a place to go that day and they didn't survive from the day before to the morning of. Was that accurate? What happened with that?
There were six kittens at Salt Pond. Two of the six were sickly, tiny, and easy to catch. The other four were still active and
not easy to catch.
And so in talking with the woman that was out there with myself and another person, I explained that because of their condition that they would be euthanized. They were tiny. They were underweight. They were probably about 4 weeks old, three, 4 weeks old. They were very tiny. And so when they went, they were euthanized. And when I spoke with the person the next morning, there was a miscommunication. She thought that we were going to be holding them for her. I thought that I was clear that we weren't going to be holding. And that's the other four were taken that day. They were picked up at Salt Pond.
By her?
By the same person, by another person.
I'm guessing I know who that is. There's a friend of mine. I haven't talked to her, but she has almost like an independent fostering program. Is that right? Gives the cats away, the kittens away, the other places?
There's a variety of people that do work with cats on the island, and they do a trap, neuter, and return program, or they get kittens from stray litters that they do raise, have spayed or neutered, and placed.
Okay. Well, I know that many, many people care. I would like to think that this number of animals going down that go in is because of successful spaying.
Yes. Over the last 5 to 6 years, we have spayed or neutered over 17,000 animals. That has to have an impact on the island. That has to start decreasing the population. And that's the goal of our programs. That's what we are working towards, is to decrease the number of unwanted homeless animals on the island.
I'm a person who really loves animals. I've got a lot of them. I'm not quite your nightmare customer, but I have run a small school, and we placed all of the kitties and puppies that we did have, but we did allow a litter from a dog and a cat, because it's really an excellent learning experience. The kids really gain a lot from that. A challenge that I had that really caused that litter from the cats, though, is I'm in an economic window that had placed me above the ability to have the Humane Society spay my animal. I had to go to a regular doctor, but the regular doctor wouldn't spay that young. So my cat got pregnant before I could get her spayed. And I think that those are an issue. And then I get all these cats that I have to spay, and then it's like an overwhelming cost.
So, well, currently, and for the last 2 years...
This is longer ago than 2 years.
We have a spay-neuter assistance program, so that a female cat is $40. And the question that we ask people is, of that 40, how much can you afford? And we work it from there, because we do provide subsidized or free surgeries with a application, and it is income dependent, and how many dependents are supported by that income. But we can provide financial assistance to people, because we do want the animals altered, and we don't want money to be an issue that stops people.
Because I think that that's really key. We have a caller, so we'll take this call. Aloha, thank you for holding. You're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, are you accepting calls yet?
Yes, I for 5 minutes we've been happy to. You're on.
I gotta wait 5 minutes?
No, you're on. You could have come on 5 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. I just think that while we're talking about euthanasia, you know, and that's an interesting term. Because basically you're talking about killing cats, you're talking about killing dogs. You know, why can't they say it?
Okay, killing cats and killing dogs. We can use that word. So these animals die because, okay, they're not. No, don't use that.
No, the whole point I'm getting at is that we'd like to cream coat everything. We like to say euthanasia, when actually, you know, they're putting to sleep more cats than dogs, and it's wrong. But I understand the problem, because I mean, there's choke cats.
Let me ask you, because you're bringing up something really important. If you were in charge, if you had either one of these people's jobs, whether you're paid or not paid, because I have both in the room here, what would you do if you had... I have to ask myself the question. It's really easy for me, not being in that building, to say, hey, you know, let's hang on to them all. But if you had 2,000 cats in the year, what would your choice be? How would you manage it?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call it euthanasia.
Okay, we can call it killing.
I would be honest. Okay. I'd say, hey, I've got 2,000 feral cats coming in a month. Yeah, we gotta gas these.
Okay. All right. So we'll be strong with the terms, and I actually didn't even. Okay.
Yeah,
so being strong
real.
With the term, being
be real.
Real. We're being
be real.
Real. So would you kill these cats?
These gals that are going around and catching feral cats, and then getting them neutered, and then releasing them into the community. I guess that is a start. However, not all of us are cat lovers, you know? I mean, and I know that where cats are is attracts other cats that haven't been neutered and stuff like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you might be a bleeding heart and stuff, but the fact is there's a big problem with feral cats. There's a big problem with chickens. There's a big problem with dogs to some degree.
I think with the cats, and I love the cats, a big problem with the cats is that we've got all these birds. Actually, it might be a problem with the dogs. We've got all these...
Let me just share this with you.
And then I've got another caller. Uh-huh.
I've caught feral cats that, you know, once you get them in the cage... If you even come close to putting your finger by the cage, they're going to nail you. I mean, these are mean she-lions. And I've also had the Humane Society come out, and when we try to take them from my cage to their cage, they escape because the cages don't line up.
Yeah, they're pretty wild. I've used welding gloves before.
And the word euthanasia comes from the Greek word, or is from the Greek word, and it means good death in Greek. So basically, euthanasia is saying good death.
Okay.
Yeah.
So well,
they're not mean coding it. Yeah, they're
okay,
just saying.
Okay. So why don't we? I don't live in Greece. Why don't we just say good death, you know?
Okay, yeah. Well, thank you.
It's a painless way of dying.
You know, exactly. And I'm not putting down their work or anything like that. But I also feel in the same breath that we pay a lot of money and a lot of publicity to animals when there's human beings that are hurting.
Yeah.
That's
and,
a,
so,
well, at least,
and so what's the next step? We're going to go a good death to these guys, you know?
At least we're not doing it like probably other places do it where they
just
just strike the animal to kill it and that's not a good death. So, I mean.
Yeah.
So thank you, caller. And I got your last point and we'll talk about that in a little bit because like,
all
do
right,
we do this
Felicia.
To people? I mean, like that's something that like, you know, you can sit there and you look a little bit further on down the line, you know, do we spay, neuter and exterminate people as the decades go on? I mean, that's a real fear that people have. And do we, as humans, get chipped? I mean, there's the same problem with humans as there are with animals, and we have 25% housing insecure. It's a very, very serious issue, and I think that that adds to the problems with the animals. Do I have another caller?
Mm-hmm.
Aloha. Thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Aloha, Felicia. Aloha, Penny. This is Victoria. How's it?
Good.
First of all, I want to say thank you, Penny, because I believe a whole lot of what you do is really advantageous for our communities.
Victoria, call right back. Somehow something got cut off. Do we have another caller? Okay, we had a phone problem, so she'll call back. Maybe this is her. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, aloha.
Hi.
I just want to make, you know, like to just suggest that, I'm not a cat guy at all whatsoever. In fact, the more I know people, the more I miss my dog. But I'd like to suggest, if you don't want the cats, you might get used to a bunch of rats. I mean, there's a feral cat hanging around the house I just moved out of, and, the feral cat, you know, when the feral cat moved in, there was a lot less rats running around.
And you know what, you're bringing up a really good point, because I know when I've talked to the feral cat task force, and they're basically looking at changing the definition of feral over time, at least that's what I interpreted, so in time it would be backyard cats. My backyard cats are actually working cats. I have a whole lot of food in my yard, a lot of fruit, and I would have a lot of rats.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a couple of cats. And we have ecosystem balance kind of basically going on. They're pretty kind, good cats, and they've got a job, and they like their job in my yard. And so we, you know, when we didn't have cats, we didn't have rats. So if we take the cats out, we might still have even then a burst of rats.
Yeah, like a friend of mine, you know, he told me he killed a centipede the other day. He was outside. He wasn't bothering you. You know, the centipedes that eat the ants, and the chickens eat the centipedes. And, you know, and everybody, you know, helps everybody else. The food chain, you know, works all by itself.
All right. So, thank you so much.
All right. God bless.
Aloha. God bless. Aloha. You're on the air. Thank you. Sorry we lost you somehow.
That's okay. Did you hear any of what I said?
You appreciated them. You said, thank you for doing a good job.
Okay, right. So I do appreciate you, Penny, and all your folks. I'm one of those folks that picks up stray cats when I can and rehabilitates them. And they are not ferocious lions for long with love and attention. You can turn them. You totally can turn them. What it comes down to, I think, is quality of life. So if an animal, a stray animal, is in the wild, and usually when we see them, they are not fat and fluffy. They're usually skinnier than skinny, and a lot of them have mange, and a lot of them have been abused by people that are uncaring of animals, you know, in the parks, what I've noticed. So I think that there's a happy medium somewhere with the quality of life issue to be talked about, that you can release some of them after you've spayed them and gotten them healthy and defleased them and all of that. And if you send some to Kitty Heaven or wherever they go, quality of life is better than living destitute in a jungle with not enough food. Yeah, there's centipedes, but chickens get those. And yeah, there are chickens, but chickens are sometimes hard to catch. So I think we all do what we can do, and I think you guys are doing a good job. My concern now is that you folks are talking about the one side. Felicia, where is one of the employees that talked about being upset about Penny's practices? I kind of feel like it's one-sided, and that maybe we should have one of those staff members that is upset about the situation of too many cats and dogs being euthanized to try to balance the table a little bit.
Okay, you're bringing up a really good point, and I know Penny did have a response to what you're saying, but I like that you're asking a question that is close to policy, unlike how this show goes. Generally speaking, when there's a difficult situation, what I like to do is bring in the primary source first so that they are – sometimes I can bring in both sides. This seemed like a highly charged topic, and yeah. I have to honor Penny and Emily for coming in here because you're definitely coming – they're definitely coming into a hot seat.
Right.
So I am very willing to have staff people come in or if they want to call in. I'm also conscious, though, that if I have a staff person in, you know, they could lose their job, right? Or they might feel that they could lose their mm-hmm. job. So let me let Penny respond to what you had said earlier, and then I have actually have an idea. Penny?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the feral cats and your comment about some of them can be out there, and that is part of what the feral cat working group is looking at with Councilmember Yukimura in putting together a bill that we will propose to council about how to manage the feral cat population on the island and having managed colonies that are cared for by a caregiver. And they are in places that are safe, and they are not a threat to the endangered species that are on the island. Because
right,
that is one of our biggest concerns is the endangered birds. And they're very fragile, and their habitat has to be protected. So how do we find the balance between a well-managed feral cat colony and a location for an endangered species? And those are some of the things that we are working on now. I think there's 12 of us on the working group that are putting together recommendations of how we can have the cats and the wildlife cohabitate safely.
Awesome.
So anything further, or thank you, caller?
What else did I want to say? Just that there are a lot of people in the community that when we do come across strays, that we all love them. We want to keep all the animals. If I kept all the animals that I came across, I would be a zoo, you know? But unfortunately, because of this issue, and it's, you know, now a very present issue, but even in the past, my concern is, oh no, I got to find a home for it. I'm not dropping it off at the Humane Society. They're going to put it down within a week.
I echo that?
Yeah, so that's my concern, and to dispel that myth would be great, and just working on the issue would be great.
Emily has something to say on that.
Yeah, Victoria, I hear exactly what you're saying, but you made the statement, if you brought them all home and kept them, it would be a zoo. That is the issue that we have within the entire island. If everybody can't take them all home at this time because it will be a zoo, they come to the Humane Society. And so then we have the issue of then making challenging decisions as we have capacity issues ultimately as well. As
right.
Penny described with the dogs, that hasn't been so much of an issue, but with the cats, there's so many of them. So decisions do need to be made. Unfortunately,
right,
it's
go ahead.
I just said unfortunately, it's just the nature of how this problem has evolved. And I would also like to agree with you that feral cats aren't all these wild animals, and they can be turned into loving pets. In fact, I have a feral at home myself that when I first found him was exactly as you described, very ill and emaciated, and now he's a very happy house cat that does not want to leave the house.
Oh, yeah. I've done it to 16 cats over the years. I mean, turned really out of the bush, crazy wild, couldn't get near me, to purring, loving, wonderful animals. So there's always solutions, and it's great that you guys are there and open and talking about it. I appreciate you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. And when I was looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, do I need to get another dog? You know, I really don't need to get another dog. But when we have a problem with this, we need to donate or we need to adopt. We need to be a part of the solution.
It is part of being the solution. And the Humane Society is doing the job that it is mandated to do, which is to provide a safe haven for the animals when they have nowhere else to go. People should take responsibility for their animals, and they can work at placing the animal themselves. The animal, if it is your animal, it is your responsibility to take care of that animal, and if you can't take care of it, to find proper placement for it. We should be used as the last resort, because unfortunately we can't guarantee that we will be able to find him a home. And even if we make the animal available for adoption, we can't guarantee someone is going to choose that particular animal. So it's very hard, and we do have to make hard, painful decisions on a regular basis, which is why we've looked at the transfer program and what other avenues, what other venues are available. We are constantly expanding the transfer program. What started out with two shelters is now multiple shelters up and down the West Coast, including Washington State and Oregon. And we are branching out and looking at individual rescue groups to place these animals.
That's great. I've got one more question.
Okay, and I do have a caller holding.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
One quick question. Once you euthanize all the animals that you do, what happens to them? Do they turn into cat kibble and dog kibble for old Roy, or do you turn them into ashes?
We have a crematorium for the animals at the shelter.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Aloha.
And Aloha.
And caller, second caller, thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
You know, hello, Penny, and the other woman.
Emily.
Hello, Emily.
Hello. Hi.
First of all, we should have stricter laws. I'm getting a feedback. Are you hearing me okay?
I hear you fine.
We should have stricter laws. All animals, all dogs and cats should have to be spayed or neutered. If you want to breed your cat for any reason, like to indulge your kids at school like you did, Felicia, Or if you want to breed cats to sell or anything, or hunting dogs, you should have to pay buku bucks for special licenses to do so. I mean, I'm all for pig hunting, even though the Polynesians should have never brought pigs over here, and probably chickens should have never been brought.
Well, they needed to eat something, so that's
why
they
There was fish, wasn't there? You know, and anyways, pigs are a problem, so it's okay. You go out and hunt, but, you know, who needs 10 or 15 dogs? Who even needs 5 dogs? I think if someone wants to have 10 dogs, they should pay a lot of money for a license, a hunting license, to be able to own that many dogs, and also make an agreement for somebody to come out from the SPC on a yearly basis to check their dogs out. Because one thing I found out from dealing with the SCCA, unless your dog is emaciated and ready to starve to death, you can see all their ribs showing, like they're totally underfed, and they'll still pass the test. The SCCA has to, because they're underfunded, et cetera, et cetera.
Are you saying the ASPCA, the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals? Is that what
I'm saying the SCCA. When they go out and check on hunting dogs, if they see all their ribs are showing, they usually pass the test. they have to be basically emaciated and ready to be starved to death. And I think the rule should be, hey, look, we can ticket you because you're obviously not feeding your dogs good enough. And it's just like a traffic citation.
Well,
because,
thank you for that.
Well,
suggestion.
I have something else to say.
Okay, and
by
then
the way,
I got more people holding.
You other two callers took a lot of time too, okay? Besides, we indulge ourselves with pets like you did with the children. You're going to teach your children that it's cute to see babies, kittens born, and how to handle them and stuff.
And all of them got placed.
Look what happened. That's a big, huge mistake that a lot of us do, okay? Yeah, and like I say, I'll just emphasize.
Okay. And then this is your last point.
Oh,
it is.
Okay.
So wrap it up.
By the way, Scott Sims is one of the best vets in Kauai.
He is.
Who is a real decent human being aside from all the animals that he's saved. He's also he probably is owed a fortune in money from pig hunters that bring their dogs in, get them stitched up, fixed up, and then don't pay the bills.
Okay.
He's probably, okay. And
thank you.
He just got. Listen, don't cut me off, Felicia. He's just,
okay. So we have another caller. Aloha, you're on the air. Aloha, you're on the air. Oops. All right. We lost that one. So I have a couple questions and suggestions. Having been on a lot of boards. And what I'm catching is that there is some very serious concern among a portion of the staff. On the board, is there a staff member? It seems like maybe having a member of the staff be one of the board. Is that something? How is the board selected?
The board is, we have a selection committee that we discuss what the needs of the board, the numbers of the board is in our bylaws. And the board is continually searching for appropriate members, and then we discuss it within the board. As far as staff members being on the board, that's not within the bylaws and what would be appropriate. The role of the board is to oversee the policies, to hire the executive director, and it's the executive director's responsibility to be working with staff members, so that would create a conflict. It's an interesting suggestion.
Maybe you could suggest that to them, because a lot of times when you really want a good balance is that you have representation from each group,
yeah,
right?
We recognize that there is concerns within the staff. We've been working with, I won't go into exhaustive details about those concerns because of privacy issues. But we do recognize that there's concerns with the staff. We are looking for ways to continue to grow and improve our connection with staff, understanding of staff, while at the same time minding the respective roles and responsibilities of the board versus the executive director. But you're absolutely right. We do recognize this is something that we need to address and to improve upon.
Well, in any organization, even like here at KKCR, we have... like one or two programmers on it. We try and make sure that we really get a rounded perspective. And a lot of times that's a way to not have, it's just a suggestion.
We do that as well on the board. That's why we have the committee that...
Yeah, but then that just begs the question, because who selects the committee?
No, but we do try to... The purpose of the searches is to round out the various different... skill sets and viewpoints within the board to round that out. We do that.
Okay. We have another caller on the air. Aloha, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hey,
oops.
Can you guys hear me?
Oops. We
hello?
Okay, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it?
Good. And for the last caller who just got cut off, call back. Okay. Go
so,
ahead.
So on the feral cat issue, I will agree that when my neighbors had cats, I'm a dog guy, there was a reduction in rodents. However, only small rodents, because even as seasoned as a cat was, there was some big rats that they had to use my pit bulls to help kill, where they flushed them to my dog, and my dog would actually kill them.
Mm-hmm. My dog gets most of them, too. They triangle it, the cats flush them, the dog gets them. I think that's correct.
So, but when the cats did move in, I lost all my Mungitos. So I like my Mungitos on my house, but then when they died off, then the Mungitos came back, and then he'd get another bunch of cats, and then the Mungitos would go too. So even though they said they will kill birds.
Yes.
Right?
That's true.
They're going to kill things no matter what.
Matt, we're getting towards the end of the show. Do you have a question?
I have a statement. My statement is, I don't have a problem with people's cats being free versus having them in the house. But what I have a problem with is when I go to Walmart or behind the medical center across Walmart or Coquille Grove, and there's people feeding them down at Lydgate, bringing them food, you know, and that's what I have a problem with. Right? You can say the compassion side of it all you want, but that's an enabler right there. You know, I see all these people. I personally have turned people in because behind the medical center, somebody was putting feed and water underneath the bench where the people go and smoke their cigarettes. And I pointed out that that's a health violation because you got these birds, because the birds come and eat it, right? Even rodents will go and eat the leftovers that the cats will eat. So I really have a problem with these people going in public and having 30 or 40 feral cats that they're feeding and taking care of. That has to stop. That right there is like a big no-no to me. Versus if you guys are going to try and take the liberties of somebody having their pet roam the neighborhood.
So thank you so much for that input. And I got people holding. Thank you so much.
Yeah, aloha. Bye.
Aloha. And Jazz with John will be up next. Aloha, thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Okay, that's me.
Yeah.
Well, I'll try to be short. I'm Charlie Brown. I have some high points. One problem is access to the Humane Society. That would help people learn how to calm down the cats that are brought in and train the people to... Well, it works both ways. The people would learn how to handle the animals better and more friendly, and the animals would learn how to be more friendly to the people. I'd like that to happen. I'd like access to the Humane Society. That would keep it from being a not talked about chest can. So on the other hand, there'd be the cat acropolis, and that would need a cat caretaker, which is similar to the farming problem of somebody with low income because they don't... They like animals and nature more than money, so they're naturally going to be poor.
Right.
And,
I guess
these are enough points for the shortness of time.
Okay, there are a lot of challenges, but thank you. And at first I thought you were going to say you can't take a big left-hand turn out of that place. That is so true, getting out of the Humane Society.
And we're
well,
told...
no problem walking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're told that we're going to be getting a left turn lane.
Yeah.
As you come out.
Yeah, an ingress so lane or something, because that is... Sometimes I'll go right and go to Halfway Bridge and turn around. Okay, we have another call. Aloha, you're on the air. Thank you for holding.
Aloha, yes. That left-hand turn lane will not be a non-profit lane. First of all, Felicia, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it. I want you to know that in the nonprofit world, other than KKCR, because everyone there works as a non-paid person.
Yes, we're volunteers.
You could be on the board. While a nonprofit such as the Koi Humane Society or the American Cancer Society or any other nonprofit has employed paid employees,
okay,
they should not be on the board. And that's best practices.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And then secondly, could we get either one of the two to explain what really the Koi Humane Society really is trying to do here on Koi? That's all.
Okay, who wants to take that? Penny, Emily?
Thank you.
I'll take it. What we're trying to do is promote the human-animal bond and the intrinsic value of an animal and how wonderful they are, and for people to take responsibility for whatever animal they bring into their home and provide a permanent, responsible, and loving home for the animal, for the entire life of the animal. Provide spaying and neutering and tender care.
And there's shots, too.
Vaccinations, the medical care, whatever the animal needs. And if they feel that they cannot provide that, then they find a responsible placement for the animal.
Right.
But it is... It's vital that people recognize the value of an animal that they have. And so we are there to provide assistance to the public when they're having trouble with their animal. We're a safe haven when they've lost the animal and the animal comes to us. We will care for it so that they can find it, and to provide resources when they're struggling with their animal, whether it's our vaccination clinic, our food bank, our spay-neuter assistance program, our behavior helpline, training, advice, temporary shelter if there is a disaster. These are all things that the Humane Society can provide for people.
Thank you. And we have two more people holding. So, aloha, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Felicia, for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's on your mind?
I have some concerns, and I want you to ask. I'll get off the phone after I address them. It's my understanding that of the 13 people that signed to ask to resign, they were mostly managerial, and she has now suspended two of those people that signed the petition. And I'd like her to address that, and I'd like her to address it honestly, because from what I know, she has given a lot of misinformation to the public. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, so I'm not sure which of the she's are. I'm assuming Penny. So what he's saying there is of the people who have voice complaint, two have since been suspended or lost their job. Is that correct?
They have not been suspended, nor have they lost their job. There are two employees that are on paid administrative leave.
So let's just address that for a moment, not necessarily those specific individuals, because there might be...
There are personnel issues.
Personnel issues that you might not be able to speak on the radio about that directly. But to me, as a neutral third party, it seems that there must be some sort of chemistry issue here, personality conflict, something. Like, what is going on that this anger was brought up in a way where a signed statement was given to the board? What happened? Where was the communication breakdown? Why are you being blamed for this, or why are the both of you being blamed for the problem?
There's some internal issues with
this
staff.
This is Emily.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and there's concerns that have been raised by the staff. The board has listened to those concerns, is addressing those concerns. But to go beyond that and to get into details, I'm sorry, it just wouldn't be appropriate. It's not fair to all the individuals involved. But just know that the board is very concerned about issues that have been raised, and we are addressing concerns.
I would think, being that this is not a pound, there's a big difference when the county is, like, hiring it. This is a nonprofit, right? So it's very important when it's donation-based that we keep the confidence up,
right,
of the people who are making the donations.
Right.
And I honestly don't have a bias. A lot of topics here I have to really claim a strong bias. I have a bias towards the animals, but I know that I'm probably, you know, not the ideal animal owner, because... you know, I got barks or, you know, something like that. They poop or, you know, whatever. It seems like any more is against the law to be a dog. And
I understand that there's concerns, and the community is obviously, good portions of the community are very concerned about what's going on. I encourage the community members to come into the Humane Society, to walk the halls, to see the halls. And also to talk with us about this last caller describes misinformation that is claimed that Penny has put out or the board has put out. That is not the case. Come in and see, and let us talk to you. Let us walk through it, versus it being a snippet on a short show like this. We'd be happy to show you. Come on in and let us talk to you about it.
Our website has our statistics, it has our last audited financial, it has a description and an outline of all of the programs that we have. We are trying to be as transparent as we possibly can be.
Okay.
But I can assure the public that the animals at the shelter are well cared for, they are clean, they are happy when they are available for adoption, they are getting incredible amounts of exercise and social interaction with people.
Okay, and thank you for that. I have three callers holding, so I'm going to give them bing, bing, bing. They got to come on real fast, state their issue, and We're going to have to go because Jazz with John's going to be up, and we're going to have the county council report before then. So we're going to hear it, and then both of you know that this seems to be such a strong issue that very likely on an upcoming show there may be another perspective shared. Aloha, you are on the air.
Aloha, Felicia.
Aloha.
You know...
Quick, because we're almost at the end of the show.
I have been listening the whole time, and I don't know what the issue is. Like, why? What are people accusing her of, and what is her perspective? I'm confused.
Me too.
An animal advocate, and I want to make sure the animals are being protected.
Okay, that's a really good point, and I know I got two more callers holding.
We don't have to, like, pad this thing. Like, she's been accused of, like, not cleaning cages or over-euthanizing, but, like,
yes.
Really, what is the issue? Is it, like, a personality thing, or are the animals really not being taken care of? We need to know that.
Well, I that's not super clear to me either. I mean, it's a whole team that's in there, so I imagine it's not just her who's washing the cages or her who's taking care of the animals.
Yeah, I
know. So it's to me, from the outside, it sounds like a team dispute. It clearly there is a very difficult situation there. Most people who work at an animal shelter probably love animals. Nobody wants to see these get killed, and I my guess is that it's like, wow, why are we killing all these animals? And the bottom line is we have too many of them.
Well, we have to because we have a problem. I've done that job. I understand that part. I just want to know what specifically is the complaint and have her address that. I mean, that's what this program was supposed to be about.
Okay.
I think we've discussed it. I mean, there is concerns by the staff, and there's staff issue, and we're working to address those. We can't go into details about that.
Yeah, but, you know, when you say it's a private matter, this is our island. I don't know how long you've been here, but I've lived here 30 years. And the animals, I'm a steward of the land. So forget the politics and the privacy thing. We need to know what is happening and how we can contribute to solving it, period.
And we are just about at the top of the hour. I know you're asking a really key question, and we've been trying to isolate that. And so you are – Penny's raising her hand 20 seconds.
And I can't give you specifics other than to tell you that there are personnel issues that do not affect the care of the animals. And that I want to stress is that the animals are doing fine at the shelter.
Okay, then you guys get someone in there professionally to facilitate you so the whole island and the animals don't have to eat we don't have to eat it because of your personality problem.
That's a point well taken.
Thank you for that point. I'm going to take one more call. Aloha, thank you for holding. You are on the air. And you got 1 minute. You're on.
Hello.
1 minute.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
The statistics, in my view, show exactly what's going on. There's made about yet less euthanasia, but let's look at the good things that Kauai Humane does, the adoption. There's 400 less dogs adopted out in 2015 compared to 2013. There's looks like 600 less return to owner from 2000. That's 1,000 less good outcomes. So we hear a lot about 500 less euthanasia, which is a bad outcome, but we don't hear anything about why 1,000 less animals.
There's 2,000 less. I'm looking at the numbers. There's 2,000 less animals who came in. So there's 1,000 less that were killed, and 1,000 less that made it into homes. So that's
now, there's
the 2,000.
500 less that were killed, 2780 to 2228. I'm going from 2013 to 2015. So
at 2010. So okay.
Yeah, Penny came at the end of 2013, and that's what I was talking about. So the real question is solved by the live release rate, and there's a thing called the Asilomar Accord. And this is a agreement by animal shelters that the live release rate, which is shown on the website, is the most important statistic.